The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast is brought to you by Antonio Sanciolo, Michael Krug, Eric Trevarthen, Christian Walker, Tony Bishop, Renee Christensen, Melanie Nazelrod, Raymond Caritas, Michael Feinwiger, and Russell Catt.
Do you really screw up Melanie?
Yes,
of all the names.
I was just like
Eric Trevarthen.
It was butchered. It was bumped in between
Trevarthen and
Christensen.
A fine substitute.
Christensen and Nazelrod.
I think that is how it's pronounced.
I know. Yes. It's just two weird names. Like
Milani Nazelrod. Yes. All right. This one goes out to you.
She's an elf now.
Yes.
Major Spoilers theme song!
The Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air. On the air. The Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air. On the air. Podcast.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven. If you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast,
The Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 510 of the Major Spoilers Podcast, all Zach on film. Some people said, hey, you guys remember back in your very first episode how you guys said you were only going to do this once a week, and now you're doing the Major Spoilers Podcast twice a week. Well, guess what? We're going to end that pretty dang soon. Mm. Ding, dang, diddly. We're going to make Zach on film its own standalone show.
Mm-hmm.
People saw a thing that we did a couple of weeks ago, Finally Friday. We'd like to make that a regular show.
Yeah, that was fun.
But Zach on film this week is Pulp Fiction, and you got that figured out there, Zach?
I don't think so.
Zach is trying to work his microphone.
So, Zach, I'm just gonna raise when you have a boom stand like that, you have to figure out which way it tightens and then configure it so that gravity is going in the opposite direction of that, so that it actually tightens itself with gravity.
Yes. So I'm going to bet that you probably need to rotate.
You probably need to rotate.
You need to loosen up the boom arm.
Yeah.
And then rotate everything up. And then, which way is making it more loose? Okay. So that way is tightening it up.
Yep.
Yeah.
So keep tightening it up. We're going to do a new podcast, a video podcast called Zach on production.
Watch Zach
equipment.
Screw up really simple equipment.
Yep.
All right. So, Rodrigo, you're back in the studio again this
week. I am.
People have been asking for weeks now.
Yeah.
When's Rodrigo coming back into the studio? Because we love the crisp, clear sound of Stephen processing the heck out of your voice.
Well, it's better when you don't have to process the heck out of my voice.
It's being processed right now through our compressor limiters.
Well, that's fine, because throwing in a little limiter here or there is not a big deal. But having to surgically extract what essentially sounds like an aerosol can being shaken inside a larger aerosol can is actually problematic. And of course, last set of podcasts that we recorded, I wasn't here at all.
Yeah, why was that?
I was out in
Wichita that time. Okay.
Yep, shooting some basketball because the association of schools was like, "Hey, who wants to do our basketball games?" And all the PBS stations were like, "Meh," except for us, and we're like, "We'll do it.
We need the money.
We need the money, please."
Well, we would love to have you here on every single episode. And so, Rodrigo, how can we ensure that you're here every single episode? He said ham-fistedly.
Yes. If you would like to ensure that I, Rodrigo, am here with the highest audio quality possible and also the highest amount of me being here possible, you can do a handful of things. First off, if you like buying stuff, you can always go to the Major Spoilers website. That's majorspoilers.com. And click on the Amazon link, and then buy whatever you were going to buy on Amazon anyway.
For example, maybe a copy of Pulp Fiction.
Maybe a copy of Pulp Fiction. Maybe a new boom mic after all of the...
boom stands. I think they're $52 on Amazon.
After all of the locks have been stripped.
Yes.
Yes.
So I had that boom stand for 5 weeks, and now I got to buy a new one. Thanks, Zach.
Well,
the response, Zach, is, that's what I'm here for, sure, sir.
Well, it's just that Robergo hasn't been here since I don't think we've got
that's right.
We had this set up.
That's,
he hasn't been here.
I bought a new microphone just for Zach so that when all three of us are here, Zach has the same clear fidelity, and then Rodrigo doesn't show up for 12 weeks.
So Zach has been sitting on my chair, which explains, I think, why the back is so tight. Anyway... yeah, well, that's one of the things you can do is buy cool stuff through us, and it's no additional cost to you, and we'll get some cash out of the deal from Amazon. The other thing you can do, and one thing that we would like for you to consider, is to make a recurring donation to Major Spoilers. All it takes is you going to, there's a button for it, right?
Right over on the right side.
And just follow the instructions
right
there.
Under our funding goat.
Yep. And you can make a $2, a $5, or a $10 donation. And I think you can actually set up different amounts of donations, but those are the levels that we feel are going to be most comfortable for people. We have a goal that if we get a certain number of $5 donations, we should be able
to have Rodrigo here all the time.
We can... do Major Spoilers full time, and that means that I will be here for every podcast, and also you will see more stuff from me on the site because you know, honestly, my presence on the site is meager.
Yeah,
because I just do not have time to write stuff for the show.
People want to see more of those casual 60s, some deck recommendations. You know, get some more of that,
and yes, that will mean more gaming stuff, more Magic stuff, more D&D stuff. And probably just, I don't know, more dinosaur stuff. I'll see what I can find. Yeah.
And kind of tying back into Zach on Film this week, anytime we need an article from Rodrigo, I can just yell over my shoulder, bring out the GIMP.
Yep.
And Rodrigo will come out, yeah, sure. The master would like to see you now.
Yes.
So that's how everyone can help us. It can help us take Major Spoilers to the next level and get this Zach on Film thing underway.
Yeah.
Hey.
This week on Zach on Film, from 1994, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. Were you born in 1994?
I was. My parents debated on taking me to this movie.
Really? Seriously?
No, not a chance.
I can't imagine you were like 5 or 6.
I was 3.
Oh, okay. Oh, so appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty close.
So, I remember when I saw
the... most of the stuff we feed him is pulp. We can take it to this.
That's why his colon is so clean.
I did actually look, and like sometimes I go to IMDb and they like do the parental guidance thing. I just look at to see what they list on the thing, just because I think it's fun sometimes. And they said 15 and plus for this movie.
Yeah.
That doesn't even hit like the rating MPA get them.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
So the first time I saw this, I mean, we had no idea what Pulp Fiction was about. I mean, you saw maybe a trailer in a movie theater, but we didn't see stuff on... I don't remember seeing television commercials of this. Maybe you did, Rodrigo. Nah. Did you go to theater to see this, or are you too young?
No, I was too young, so it wasn't until years later that I finally saw it on video.
So our we used to have two movie theaters here in town. We have the Mall Theater that back then was two theaters. Maybe it was four. No, it was two still.
And
two
then,
screens.
And then the Haunted movie theater.
And then we had the Fox Theater, which was an old movie house theater, and it still had two... screens there. It used to be a big open balcony that would go down in one theater, and then they closed that off I don't know when, and so you have a screen upstairs and you have a screen downstairs, and the screen upstairs still had kind of balcony seating. It was probably the best one to sit at, and because of the balcony arrangement, they had the aisle right in front before you go down to the stuff closer to the stage and the stuff that went up, and that was always the best place to sit because no one would walk in front of you. I remember going to see Pulp Fiction and sat down, and I forget who I went with. Maybe Skrull Bryan and I went and see it together. I remember there was a couple of us that went to see it. And who walks in just before the movie starts?
Quentin Tarantino.
Samuel L. Jackson.
Even better. The president of our university and his wife. And we had no idea what was going on. And then about 15 minutes into the film, the president and his wife exit the theater.
Awesome.
Epic.
Why, young Zach, would the president and his wife exit the theater?
Now, are they still are they still the same president and wife?
Same president.
No.
Same president.
Nice.
Not the same wife. The less said about that on this show is probably it.
All right. Well,
probably I'm gonna guess he got up and left because of the very let's say mature nature of Pulp Fiction.
Well, the first 10 minutes you have a very lengthy discussion of oral sex and how to perform oral sex on
yes,
a woman.
That is true.
And that may have been the trigger. As well as maybe we should maybe this needs to have an explicit tag if you haven't figured it out already. Because there is a lot of foul language in Pulp Fiction. And especially when Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta get going, it gets pretty vulgar at times.
Oh, yeah.
And that's basically, you know, your opening scene is two guys driving in a car talking about...
Well, the opening scene isn't that the diner.
Well, yeah, in the diner.
Yeah, the little prologue thing.
But it's...
It's not very
and you really don't know. I mean, you've got the Bonnie situation is where it starts out, where they're talking about, you know, let's do this. I love you so much. Yeah, let's do this.
Yeah.
All right, I mean, you know, you mother effers, do this. I'm going to kill every last effing one of you. Boom, ba-dum, boom, boom, ba-dum, boom, boom. Hey. Boom, ba-dum, boom, boom, ba-dum, now, now. And then you get into the, to the first story.
Yeah.
So, Zach, give us a rundown. Give us a story-wise on Pulp Fiction.
Well, Pulp Fiction is divided pretty hard line into this three big major chunks. The first one is John Travolta and Samuel Jackson's characters, Vincent and Jules. They are some muscle for an L.A. crime lord, and they're trying to... fix some little guys in their organization who I don't know quite what they did. It didn't really explain. They stole
Mr.
They took the money from Marcellus Wallace. Yeah.
Well, they took
whatever
it was.
That
we
is.
Don't wanna,
whatever's
in
briefcase.
The briefcase.
Right. And so their story is pretty much Marcellus is sending them out to get back what is his from these little. 20-year-olds that decided to mess with a very big bad man. And so that story starts off, and then you go to Vincent Vega has to take Wallace's wife out because he's leaving and he wants his wife to be occupied.
You mean like taken out bang bang?
No. Taken out to a nice little diner and having some nice burgers and a $5 milkshake and doing the twist.
$5 milkshake?
Yeah.
That's kind of like, in comparison to 1994, $5 milkshake is actually quite cheap, right? You know? I don't know what a good milkshake now is about, $5 or $6. You know, a little milk.
Yeah, it'd probably be, I mean, it'd be like normal now.
Yeah, back then, I can see it'd be very expensive. I mean, back then, $5 would get you into the evening matinee at the movie theater.
Right.
The evening show, so. What else goes on?
A lot of drugs in that part.
Really?
A lot of some heroin.
What?
Yep. And some
bad language.
Some coke.
Heroin.
Then next story is Bruce Willis's character, boxer. He's supposed to lose. He's supposed to take a fall in a fight. His career's running out. Marcellus wants him to take a fall. He doesn't. Actually ends up killing the other guy in the ring. And now he is trying to leave L.A. with his wife to start a better life, but she forgot his father's watch, and then that story plays out.
And what's really interesting as we get into the big narrative of the story is Bruce Willis's character, Butch, goes back to the apartment looking for his gold watch. There, he runs into John Travolta's character, shoots him dead, right?
Kills him.
And is able to make it out, has a series of incidents, unfortunate incidents, where he and Marcellus are captured, raped, sodomized by a bunch of hillbillies. And at the end of that act, it's you leave town, Butch, and we never want to see you in this town again.
Mm-hmm.
Zed's dead, baby Zed's dead, right? And then we get back into the Bonnie situation.
Yes. From there... then it's back to the apartment of them taking care of these young guys, and they continue on from there, and they have one of their inside guys they put with these guys that did Wallace bad.
Marvin.
Yeah, Marvin, who's Phil Lamar, which was kind of funny.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, yes.
Yeah. They're driving along and talking. Travolta leans to the back with his gun, and there's a bump or something. His gun goes off, and Marvin's head is all over the car now in very many pieces.
And they got to get the situation taken care of. They can't be seen driving in L.A. with brains scattered all over the back window. Mm-hmm. They go to their nearest friend, Jimmy, played by Quentin Tarantino.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, if Jimmy's wife comes home, Bonnie, and sees, two hoodlums standing in my car with a dead body in the trunk, there's going to be a situation. So they call in Mr. The Wolf.
The Wolf.
Sorry, just The Wolf, played by Harvey Keitel. Mm-hmm. Another staple in kind of Quentin Tarantino films. And he comes in, tells them what to do, cleans it up. They end up at the restaurant, that same restaurant that the film opens with, mm-hmm. and that plays out the Honey Bunny Pumpkin situation with, what's her name? Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer are in that. And the amazing thing is, didn't we just see John Travolta get killed? Why is he alive in the next act?
Sure.
And then, Rodrigo, that brings up into the overall narrative discussion of this film. The story is completely told out of order.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's chronologically completely out of order. You see things happen, and then we go back before they happen. You find out that, you know, the very first scene in the movie, which at first seems completely unrelated, is just technically the 10th scene in the movie.
Right.
And if seen chronologically, it would make some amount of sense.
Yeah, I guess they've got it. There's 7 scenes in the movie. The prologue that takes place at the diner, the prelude to Vincent Vega and Marsalis's wife, or Wallace's wife, Vincent Vega and his wife, the prelude to the gold watch, the Bonnie situation, and the epilogue. If you put them in the chronological order that they go, it would be like story 4, story 2, story 6, story 1, story 7, story 3, continue back to story 4, and then 5, which is really kind of wiki-wacky.
Mm-hmm.
Why does that work? Why employ this, let's tell the story out of order?
It's a dangerous tool to use because you risk losing your audience, but it's an effective tool because it builds interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't want to take anything away from Pulp Fiction itself as a movie or the story or anything.
Right. First time we've seen this.
But, you know, it's a story about, you know, some mobsters and, you know, their mishaps and a lot of tangents. But if you take that story and you play it out of order and people are trying to figure out what's happening, it's a lot more rewarding when you figure out who a character is or what their involvement is than if you're watching it in order. So you kind of build this secondary system to reward the viewer for paying attention. And there are people that are really just eat that up, myself included, actually.
Oh, yeah. It really, I mean, in this situation, it really works well. And I say this isn't the first time we've seen this. I mean, for me, it was the first time I'd seen this where we're telling the story out of order. I think the only, and I have to go back and look at some release dates, but the only other film that I remember kind of doing the same thing in this same time period was 1201, which was Jim Jarmusch's movie, where it tells a story about events that happen around the world at 1201.
Mm-hmm.
And they all line up and all the stories kind of interconnect in a kind of very broad way. But there are a bunch of little short stories that have this hook of, we've told you the story, let's back up an hour and let's tell you the story again.
You know, if you want to look at, I mean, a lot of the movies that employed similar techniques are straight up like science fiction time travel movies.
Right.
Where you see
back
things,
to the future, sure.
You see things out of order because you have the protagonist's point of view and he's seeing things out of order.
Right. And you've seen Citizen Kane, right, Zach?
Yeah.
Citizen Kane kind of employs the same thing because we're seeing Kane's life told by one person. which may include Kane as a young person, mm-hmm. Kane as an old person. Now let's go interview someone else. Oh, yes, here's Kane as this middle-aged person. Right. And oh, yeah, I remember this story from when he was a young person, and we're employing that technique there as well.
So usually, prior to Pulp Fiction, and you know maybe there have been others that did it before Pulp Fiction, but really, prior to Pulp Fiction, usually filmmakers needed a motivation to tell a story out of order.
Right.
Whereas Pulp Fiction just does it for no reason other than that is the way that the story is.
Right.
So no disjointed amnesiac, no...
When did Memento came out? It came out...
2000.
Yeah.
I just looked it up. So okay. It's like five or six years after.
So if we're looking for something that may have an influence, right. Certainly Memento for Nolan does that, where you're telling the story not only out of order, but backwards through time.
Yep, exactly. So, you know, stuff like that. And the, again, it really is just Tarantino being like, I want to tell this story out of order. Woo! And like, he just does it. It's effective.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thinks it's awesome, pretty much.
And because a lot of people imitate that.
Everybody loved Pulp Fiction.
So were you in college then when this was on the VHS?
I don't... I probably was in college when I first saw it.
But it had already been out for...
It had already been out for...
How old were you in 94?
I don't remember.
10? 11?
Yep, 11.
Okay. So still quite a few years later before you saw it in college. And were there already a lot of... Because I know whenever I went to school, mm-hmm. we saw Pulp Fiction, and then we saw it again. And then from that point on, all anyone could think about was, how can I make a film like Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
And so there was our, you know, this is the first generation of people mm-hmm. that saw this. And it's like, okay, how is this going to influence us?
Right.
How can we tell a story out of order? How can we tell these interesting angles? For me, it was all about story, especially when we talk about the pulp novel itself, mm-hmm. where you've got these very cheap stories mm-hmm. told and often containing fantastical elements like the briefcase, which mm-hmm. you could look at as a... at one point, I thought that may have been Wallace's eyes were in there, because mm-hmm. all the way up in the movie, even if you watch it in chronological order, you always see Wallace from the back, or he's always wearing eyeglasses. Mm-hmm. After they get the briefcase and the gold watch story plays out, when we get into the gold watch story, then you see Wallace's eyes. So to me, it's always like, mm-hmm. what is this fantastical element that is in here? And everybody's always wondered what that is.
Yeah.
So that's what drew me into the story. But a lot of people are always like, how can we use the same snappy dialogue that Tarantino employs throughout all of his movies?
Right.
How can we use the same kind of gangster characters that we see in Vincent and Jackson's kid, Jules, characters? You don't really see a lot of Willis imitators that came out of this.
No, he's pretty much a guy who gets sodomized.
But
is his
arc. Actually, he doesn't.
He escapes. You're right.
Oh, there's so much to talk about. It, just real quick divergence. In The Gold Watch, the best scene, in my opinion, there's so many good scenes, but one of the ones that always stands out is, here is Butch running away from the pawn shop, and his arch nemesis is being raped down in the basement, and he's almost out, and he's like, you know what? I can't do this. And so he's looking for something to mm-hmm. knock these guys out or to help Wallace out, and he grabs a hammer. And then he starts to walk, and a few steps later, he's like, oh, baseball bat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then starts swinging around, and as he swings and looks up, he sees chainsaw.
Yeah.
And then he's doing that, and he's like, oh my gosh, I found the perfect weapon. And you just cut. And it's perfect because it's like the weapons just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
I was laughing so hard.
And it's such a funny little scene. Yeah. But, you know, you see people imitating Quentin Tarantino's style a lot. We talked about that in Kill Bill. And Vega and Jules' characters are often imitated throughout, just because they stand out mm-hmm. so much. When you got into mm-hmm. school then, you would be second generation people who would see this. You wouldn't, you're not even first generation. Like, you are second generation of influence from Tarantino.
Yes. Our teachers saw Pulp Fiction before they, you know, when they were like graduating from college and stuff.
Yeah, my age. Right.
Right.
Old people.
Yes. Ancient. The ancients, as I like to refer to them.
We do not speak.
So, I had teachers, like I had a script writing teacher who showed us the script for Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, So through script writing, here's what he's conveying.
Right.
You know, and it the actual script for Pulp Fiction is cool,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that movie is just so cool in every way.
Right,
on
right,
top
right.
of it, the script itself is cool because he does things like, you know, when he's like talking to them and he's like, comprende, like the direction that follows is they comprende, and, you know, things like that. Like the script itself is also written in such a way that it complements the movie.
Right.
That said, I did run into a few of my classmates who clearly really wanted to be the next Quentin Tarantino by imitating the Quentin Tarantino aesthetic as close as possible.
So when I graduated, I went down to Atlanta. I was doing a bunch of production work, but I was also teaching part-time at university.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those kids were just like total Tarantino devotees.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say probably, I'd probably say around 30% of them were just nothing but Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
Is that about the percentage that you had in your classes? Or
no.
Was it higher or lower?
It was lower for us because, like,
you guys were squares living up there in the
kind of.
Great Northeast.
I think to a certain degree, it was the Tarantino kids, the art kids, and the kids who were doing film because of, like, an assortment of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, either because they wanted to go into the industry but not be filmmakers,
right,
and
right.
they figured a film degree was the best way to do that. Like, they wanted
to do technical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Technical stuff. And actually, we had one, like, I knew a girl who was, like, a business film double major because she wanted to be, like, a producer,
mm-hmm.
but not, mm-hmm. like, a film producer that doesn't, like,
that's
touch any sort
you're
of equipment.
You're doing a business minor, right, Zach?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, stuff like that. And then, like, me, you know, a handful of people who are like me, who are just like, well, film seems like something to do that kind of hits the requirements of creative things
right,
you know, high paying job later, potentially, clearly not though, because I ended up working for PBS, and stuff like that. So by the time that I got into school, the overwhelming Tarantino influence had decreased, but the guys that were clearly there to become Quentin Tarantinos were there and were visible.
I wonder if then that makes you a third generation then.
I don't know.
There was my generation and then five years later.
If you go by generation, you know, people graduate in 4 years.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So how many years between 94 and 2001 when I started
years,
school? So it really only be
one
full
generation.
Turn.
Okay. Yeah, because I just remember those kids coming in and just like, oh, I'm going to do this like Tarantino, and I've got to have the violence, and I've got to have the blood and guts. And you still see that today. I mean, you go online and you look at a bunch of YouTube videos, and I know that if you watch the series Film Riot. Do you watch Film Riot, Zach?
Yeah, every once in a while.
You know, he is totally, he is a Tarantino devotee.
Oh, yeah.
To an extent, I mean, he has some other favorites. Nolan, I think, is his favorite director, but you look at the shorts that they do, and they're very influenced by Tarantino's over-the-top violent style.
Yeah, definitely the violence vibe.
We had a lot, like, and for us, you could go around and be like, oh, I've, like, you know, pass around your scripts, everybody read them and give feedback, and reading through is like, oh, this guy, this script is about, like, a bunch of cool people hanging out and not doing anything but saying really cool things.
Yes.
You are a Kevin Smith.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, this is, like, hyper-violent and told out of order. You are a Quentin Tarantino.
Right.
This is also told out of order, but there's, like, a weird pointless mystery. You are a, you know, either an Aronofsky or,
Aronofsky, And what were the groups that were the, Robert Rodriguez's.
There kind of weren't. And I think more than anything, those got kind of lumped together with the Tarantinos.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because it, you know, it's like high art, high violence at the, you know, together kind of stuff is I would say is that aesthetic. You know, and we also got like guys who clearly wanted to be documentarians.
Mm-hmm.
And so any project that they did, they just went down to Chicago and found something sad and made a movie about that.
Heck, is this the first time you've seen Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
I
bought it because I knew I should watch it, and I bought it on DVD, and then like 3 months later I bought a Blu-ray player. I'm like, nah, DVDs, I need a Blu-ray. So then I bought a Blu-ray copy of Pulp Fiction, and then it's just been sitting in my shelf for probably like 8 months because I just haven't watched it.
Wow. Okay, so
that happens though. I mean, I've seen it, but like I got a Blu-ray copy of Pan's Labyrinth, which is a great movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And I haven't sat down to watch it. It's just
but you've already
there.
Seen Pan's Labyrinth.
I have seen it before. Yes.
I think that's sometimes the effect of, well, I've seen this movie. I want to own this movie so that I can sit down and watch it at any time that I want.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of been that way with the iTunes downloads. I want to sit down and watch this wherever I want, whenever I want. I've amassed a huge collection of movies that I still haven't watched, but I've seen previously.
Right.
Yeah. So, Zach, I'm very curious on your impression of this from the first time. I mean, the weird thing is, and this is something that happens a lot, is the Tarantino thing happened over 20 years ago, or close to 20 years ago now.
Yeah. Almost 20 years ago. If you're counting Pulp Fiction as the flair.
I mean, you can count Reservoir Dogs, but I mean, a lot of people...
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs is not as popular as Pulp Fiction.
Well, because
was.
it wasn't a wide release. Oh, I know we never saw it. I remember when Skrull Brian and I went and saw it, he was like, oh yeah, I was down at the video store and I found this other Tarantino movie you might find interesting, Reservoir Dogs. And I was like, what? And that's about the same time we discovered Clerks. But I'm you know, this happens a lot where, unfortunately, you've already seen the Tarantino influence. Number one, you've watched Kill Bill. Number two, you've watched Man with the Iron Fist. Number three, you're 21 years old and everything is influenced by Tarantino or has some influence on Tarantino.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you thought of watching this, even though you've seen some other Tarantino works.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Reservoir Dogs?
I actually have.
Okay, so you're really seeing this in a weird point.
In a weird point,
you're
seeing
it out of order.
Yeah, it's weird.
When I
sit down to watch all these movies, I'm like, I really wish I could have watched them when they were released because they're such big cultural...
Because then you'd be an awesome time traveler.
Right. And they're such big like cultural things, and they employed such techniques that are now common. And so it's like, oh, well, I've seen that before, but it's just 20 years after it's been done.
Right.
So, but no, I love this movie.
Why?
Why? The out of storytelling order was really cool after I thought about it last... thought about it because it like... circled almost.
Right.
Yeah, that was really cool. I love the dialogue in this one, and I feel like his dialogue's almost changed a little bit over time. It doesn't have the same speed as it does now. Like Django, nowhere near as fast dialogue as Pulp Fiction is.
You know, you're probably right, because, and if you've listened to Tarantino speak and you see interviews of him over time, he's kind of slowed down.
He slowed down.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back and watch the interviews from when Pulp Fiction came out, he was like, and it's like, slow down, man. And he's like full of energy. And then when I did see him talking about Django, it was like he was more reserved and a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I don't, maybe that's how maybe that has had an influence in how he's directed. Because if you watch the Grindhouse film, what was it? Was it called Grindhouse?
Death Proof. Was his. Yeah.
You've got that huge long sequence between the female character sitting in that diner, and that sequence is a lot slower, takes a lot longer to play out than the Vincent and Jules scene in the diner, where these discussions are not as quick back and forth bantery. One could argue that that also has to do with the editing pace and who his editor is.
Yeah.
In Django compared to Pulp Fiction. So, okay, what else?
What else did I like? Those are two really big things. I liked
the story and the dialogue.
Just the overall like pace of the movie. Because I watched this on Saturday after writing all day and then editing and then writing more.
Oh yeah.
I was like, I'm not gonna make it through this. This is almost a 3-hour movie. I started at 11 and I like didn't stop. It was so engaging the entire time. I thought I was gonna like fall asleep and not to finish it on Sunday. No. It was just...
Now did your girlfriend watch this with you?
No. No.
Would she like these kind of movies, or is this not her thing?
No.
Is she only, we can only watch Disney animated films kind of girl or not?
No.
Not to put her down.
No.
I've never met her.
Sure.
We watched Star Trek together, and she liked the new Star Trek. I tried to get her to watch Pi, but she got really freaked. She just felt like really weird. Like, this is too weird.
This is the work of the devil.
This is weird. I need to go to, and she just fell asleep. No, she definitely wouldn't like this movie. Just she's not a big fan of like
violence and language.
Yeah, violence and language is not her alley. Okay. And I was like, and I was trying to explain it to her, like IMDb had like, and like 237 F-bombs. I was like, it's because Samuel L. Jackson's in the movie. And he's like, motherfucking Samuel L. Jackson.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about use of music? Music is, plays an important role in this, especially Dick Dale's Miser Lou song. That's, again, a song from the 60s.
Right. Right. Yeah. But that has been like bonded with this movie. Like nowadays when you hear that song you think of Pulp Fiction.
Right.
To the point where I think there's a Pulp Fiction joke in Space Jam and they play that song.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Wow. Let's see. I'm trying to find out what year that song was released. 1962. So, you know, that song's been around for a long time and I knew it. I used to listen to that's growing up in high school, that's all I listened to was like 50s and 60s music. And I knew that song. So when I heard it, I was like, oh, this is a great piece. But then you listen in how it's put together, and it's got a lot more crispness than listening to it on a vinyl or a cassette or over AM radio, that it really pops and helps bring this movie to life and sets it up very quickly what this movie is about. It's hard driving. Mm-hmm. It is wild. It is
It doesn't make a lot of
control.
Sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's beach music.
Right.
Right? But it's wild, out of control, freestyling. And that's kind of what this movie kind of does. Mm-hmm. What else strikes your fancy in this, Zach?
Oh, like specific scenes. I think that the entire lead up to them walking to the guy's
apartment
was awesome with that really long take walking down the hallway. Mm-hmm. That was just a dialogue awesome scene. All the drug stuff was really cool with when Uma Thurman comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Just
Eric Stoltz is the drug dealer.
Yeah. Watch her, and really that entire scene in the diner with watching her and Travolta interact, because it's like this sense of really awkward. And even bring it up, she's like, "Don't you like that that awkward silence?" Mm-hmm. And she makes him think of something. The characters in this were just awesome.
And it's a pretty good cast of characters, too. I mean, here you have John Travolta, who at this point was his last big thing was Grease, right? Yeah. And he'd been basically written off as so long, thanks for all the fish kind of guy, as just like, bye-bye. And then suddenly appears as one of the title characters, or not the title characters, one of the main characters in here.
Mm-hmm. Samuel L. Jackson is Pulp, and he's fiction.
Yes. Samuel L. Jackson was in what before this? Still relatively new, though. But certainly this is a launching. Because
his Die Hard movie came out.
No, it came after.
After this, right. After this. After it.
Uma Thurman. This is probably the first time. I know this is the first, pretty much sure this is
big
the first time
she's in,
ever
yeah.
saw Samuel L. Jackson, Uma Thurman, in this kind of a movie. Harvey Keitel, of course, we've seen before. Tim Roth, we've seen before. Amanda Plummer, I'm trying to remember. Oh, she was in The Fisher King that came out a year or two before this.
Samuel L. Jackson was in Sea of Love as Black Guy.
Awesome.
Before this? That was
yes.
his. Oh, wow. Okay, so this was his first big thing.
Let's see. Mo Better Blues. So that's something.
Okay.
The Exorcist 3. He's in Goodfellas. But
really?
Clearly not in any sort of major
role.
Not
in a major role.
He was in Jungle Fever.
So he was doing a bunch of Spike Lee stuff.
Yep.
Have you watched Spike Lee stuff, Zach?
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Looks like Juice. So, and then eventually I'm trying to see if there's anything else that was big. Oh, he was in Jurassic Park.
Oh yeah, that's right.
The year
that's
before
right.
Pulp Fiction.
Yep. That's right. But really, as a minor character, he was the IT guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he gets one of the best lines.
Yeah.
Hold on to your butts.
So the next big question then, Zach, of course, when this film was released, critical success. I mean, both the general public and critics were just like, this is a great movie. Mm-hmm.
This is the first, like, over 200 million, wasn't it? First, like, independent. Isn't that what I think I read that.
It may have been.
Huge.
I don't know what kind of box office numbers that it got.
This is saying 213 million.
Let's see. This says Pulp Fiction wound up grossing $107.9 million at the U.S. box office, making it the first indie film to surpass $100 million. Worldwide, $213. Oh, okay. 10th largest grossing film of 1994. And it did play on a lot fewer screens, and I'm trying to remember. I think Pulp Fiction was only here for a week or two.
Really?
Because it was in and out. And again, when we would see it, hardly anybody in the theater. Because again, in this region, something where you're talking about oral sex and blowing people's heads off and heroin use and and really this film kind of glorifying those kinds of activities does not play well in Middle America. So
it won't play in Peoria?
No. Or Russell, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So the big thing then, Zach, is what do you take away from this film? I mean, we've already kind of talked about that with Kill Bill, but what now influences you more or less going forward?
So, I don't know. It's so difficult because non-linear storytelling is obviously a takeaway from this movie, but I think you get into that space of one, totally jacking up your story because you can't do it right.
Right.
Or, just doing it badly or it's a riff on someone. But I think just looking of interesting ways to tell your story that you don't have to follow the strict 5-act or 3-act or whatever, what you want to do with your story, then editing was obviously pretty big. This just the way they can it used I think fewer edits to still keep the pace of the film going by sticking on the actors as they just gave their huge long quick dialogue bursts.
Yeah, go back and watch that opening scene where they're talking about the Royale with cheese when they're riding in the car. That's really two shots.
Yeah,
maybe three. I don't remember if they do a two through the window, but I know that they're doing some shots most of the time from Vincent's side of the window with Jules driving. And it is that one long take, and the two are just popping back and forth with the dialogue. And that can, I think, that can be rather hard for actors because usually they allow a little space in between their dialogue, so it makes editing a lot easier.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when you're telling people to talk over one another or overlap with one another, it creates that tension, that pace, that craziness that often occurs, and I think that plays out really, really well here. What are the negatives of this, Rodrigo? The negative influences on this?
Well, I think that there's not a lot of substance, honestly, to Pulp Fiction. There's a lot of cool stuff that happens, a lot of awesome, film complexities that go into it that make for a really compelling movie experience, but there's not a lot going on here. And I think that,
well, I mean, it's a noir tale, right? So it's bringing back that it's got hyper violence, hyper sexuality, hyper everything.
Right.
How can that be bad?
Oh, that, I don't think that's bad necessarily. What I'm saying is, what's the movie about?
Okay.
Like
good point.
Exactly. Yeah. The movie's not actually about anything.
Right.
And that kind of has, you know, because of movies like Pulp Fiction that are all bang, it seems that it's created not just this movie, but a lot of people could say that they've been like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas started this, of movies that prize kind of action and spectacle over substance.
Mm-hmm. And so we come up with that's a typical, like, what we call a popcorn movie, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Something like Transformers or Michael Bay films or whatever. Do you think that this has a negative, is there a negative influence on culture because of this?
Not really. I think that you're going to have, people who are trying to be awesome gangsters no matter what. So whether they get that from Pulp Fiction or whether they get that from Hustle and Flow or wherever they get that from,
right,
they're gonna get it from somewhere.
Right.
I don't think that Pulp Fiction itself negatively influenced our like culture any more than anything else. I think it did influence culture.
Oh, sure, sure, sure.
But I don't think the influence is overall negative. I think it's palpable, but it's not. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's either positive or negative. I think Pulp Fiction created this shared experience for everybody who went to see it and who has seen it since, and it's just kind of an important enough movie that we are still seeing kind of echoes of Pulp Fiction in other things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, references to it, you know, attempts to capture that, any given aspect of it. You know, the violence, the dialogue, the out of time, the out of sync storytelling, all of that stuff we're still seeing.
You know, there's a very specific look to the film, and I guess it has to do with who you have as your cinematographer, your director of photography in these pieces. But oftentimes when I think of genre type films, when I think of Star Wars, I don't think of the darkish tones that we see in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. I see this 70s, it's the hardest thing, I've tried to explain it before, the 70s gloss that's painted over the 77 Star Wars film,
right,
where it has this very unique look to it.
Right.
And then the very next year when you see Empire Strikes Back, everything looks clean and pretty and, or not a year later, but, you know, 3 years later in 80, everything has this clean, shiny kind of glow to it.
Right.
Maybe because more of the special effects seep in. When I think of 80s type movies, I always think of that same glossy look that we see in Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And to me, I don't care if we're talking about Lethal Weapon or we're talking about whatever, to me they all have that same kind of look.
See, and that's interesting because, you know, you kind of went through the 80s
right.
and saw that happen.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a difference between those movies and some other movies that were coming out in the 80s.
Right.
Because, like, when I think of Blade Runner, I don't think of that clean look. Like,
but
Blade Runner is really gritty and nasty.
Yeah, but not,
and, like,
in the,
Highlander.
But not in the story, though. I mean, not in the visual look of the film. Look at, I mean, it's not grainy gritty. It's not, it is.
Yeah, it's
very
glowy.
It's glowy. It's got very specific lighting to highlight specific things.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a, it does have a gloss to it, even though everything, and it's probably because it's raining all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it has a very specific gloss to it. When you look at Brazil, it has the same kind of feel to it. It's kind of weird. A lot of people have been doing these.
Yeah, the 80s were definitely really blue.
Yes.
Like, if you look at a lot of movies done in the 80s,
I was just going to say,
everything's blue.
You can go online now, and Zach, if you're ever looking at color theory and wondering about what colors influence a movie or what color palettes influenced a movie, there's this project, and I don't know who does it or what group of people do it, but what they do is they take every scene of the film and they take a sample. Every shot of the film, they sample, and they set them side by side and just run them into one giant wraparound piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, they can run a computer program that extracts the primary colors that it finds. Look, you know those pictures where it's made up of a million other little pictures?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. The computer looks at this from a 1,000-foot view and says, well, here are the primary colors that are used in this piece. And you're right. When you look at films from the 80s, it's a lot of blue.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at films from the 90s, to me, it feels like there's always a lot of red and a lot more green in the films from the 90s. And when you look at Pulp Fiction, it's all about the reds and the greens. Red is a huge influence in this movie. Blood is a huge influence in this movie. There's probably a tie between those two, from the candy apple cigarettes that Bruce Willis smokes to the bar that Wallace owns, to the blood, to the just everything in that film is got this red tint to it. And so, you know, that kind of, to me, permeates a lot of what the 90s about. Go look at what's the big gangster movie that came out in the early to mid 90s, the long tracking shots and
Boogie Nights.
Well, Boogie Nights is a late 90s. That's the same way. Goodfellas, right? That's a 90s film, right? Pretty sure.
I don't remember.
I'll look it up real quick. But it's the same way. It kind of has this red look to everything.
Yep, 1990.
Yeah.
So you could get away with either calling it a 90s movie or an 80s movie.
It's real close. Because again, you look at Empire Strikes Back, and it has that same look to it in the 80s. You know, as the typical, how do you define that? Is it a 70s look or an 80s look? And it really, to me, defines an 80s look.
Yeah.
So you see this, and so color, I think, plays a big role in how you approach something. And when I look at the films of the 2000s, it kind of has like a washed out hazy blue to a lot of the films of the 2000s. Think of the color palette that you see in Memento.
Yep, definitely Memento. Mm-hmm. Well, it's like if you look at movies like Memento or Requiem for a Dream or stuff like that, like the whole movie is just blue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, well, I don't know. I mean, the Matrix, the Matrix is green.
Green, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I guess you could look at that faded out.
I think the 90s was a time for like a movie would like pick a color and stick with it more than necessarily there being a color that informed all of the movies, like the way that seriously everything in the 80s was blue.
Right. When you look at, green and blues are an influence, but it seems like as you move into the late 2000s, gold is a big influence in a lot of movies. And you see that kind of a glowish, warm color that permeates a movie. So looking at a color palette, I think, Zach, would be something that you might want to kind of pay attention to, because that tells you a lot about what's going on. Matrix is a good example where when you're in the Matrix, everything has a green shift. When you're out of the Matrix, everything has a blue shift.
Mm-hmm.
So I think color. I forget how we got off on this tangent, but I don't know. Uh-huh. It certainly has a look that...
I think we're just talking about the influence on the culture, and then we kind of got into that.
So... are you going to take anything else away besides story and snappy dialogue and long takes and whatnot?
I'm sure there is. I just need to watch it again.
Is this one?
You've
had several days to let this digest in your head.
Yeah, I've been busy with stuff.
Do you find yourself reflecting on movies that have an influence on you?
Yeah.
Do you sit there? I mean, I'm kind of this way. I remember the first time I saw The Game, which in itself isn't a great movie except for the hook at the end that makes you reconsider everything else that you just saw. But I remember several days later, I'm still thinking about that film and going, oh my gosh.
I was thinking about Wreck-It Ralph for like a week afterwards.
Really? How come?
Yeah. There was just like, not only like all of the little video game references, but they're just so, like the movie is really tightly written.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like everything about it that seems random actually is relevant to the plot, which is actually kind of what always annoyed me about those auteur movies from the early 90s, that they had a lot of extraneous stuff that doesn't advance the plot.
Right.
Like Wreck-It Ralph is actually a great example of how everything that happens on screen is there to advance the plot.
Yeah, important.
Even if it looks to be completely over, oh, look at this wacky video game character. Like, that character's reaction to whatever's happening at the time informs what is happening.
Right, right.
And so on and so forth. So, yeah, I actually really enjoyed Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh, yeah, we watched it again this past weekend. My son was just like, Mom, Dad, let me watch Wreck-It Ralph again. And I was like, oh, that's great. And for listeners, you know, this is not just Rodrigo and I talking. You know, we're trying to share some thoughts and ideas and cram them into Zach's head so that he can become influenced by...
the filmmaker we want him to be.
Yes, exactly. But here's a cool thing, Rodrigo. I've actually seen a recent thing that Zach did that's heavily, to me, heavily influenced by a movie that we've already talked about.
Oh, nice. Alien?
No.
No.
You know this Vine app? Have you seen this? You know what that's about?
Yeah.
So Vine
like
is where you just...
seconds of...
Yeah, you get like 6 seconds of whatever, and I guess most people are putting up their dogs farting or whatever for 6 seconds, and it just continuously loops. But Zach, explain how this Vine app works. I mean, is it just 6 seconds and that's it? I mean, there's no editing, right?
Right. No going into the video you're shooting and editing. So what Vine is you decide, hey, I want to film something. So you pull up the app and you line up your shot and you press the screen. And as long as you're pressing the screen, it's going to record. When you let off, it's done. Then you can shift to something else and touch the screen. And you're calling attention to the screen, it's going to record. And you can record and record and record. Then you have 6 seconds that you can watch the bar fill up, and then once it's done, you can play it back and you just watch the thing loop. It's just continuing this loop of the movie, so you can think of fun things to do or stupid things to do, and it's just going to continue looping.
Sure. So I did not realize Zach is such a hipster that he still listens to vinyl.
Oh yeah,
so
I just got it for last Christmas.
Zach put up a piece, a little Vine clip, this past weekend. Was it Friday or something?
Because
I know I told you about it on Saturday.
Yeah, it would have been Friday.
Okay. So he put up this little piece last week, and it's him taking the record off the shelf, putting on the platter, taking the needle off, putting the needle on, and the music playing. All in 6 seconds. And so he's done some very clever editing. But what makes the piece play off is, from the audio standpoint, there is a rhythm to this edit that just goes whatever the music that you were playing.
Fleet Foxes.
And where do you think that that's an influence from? Or at least I perceived it to be that way.
Shaun of the Dead.
Yes, Shaun of the Dead. Congratulations, Rodrigo.
Thank you.
Pi.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
It is absolutely. I watched that and I was like, oh my gosh, there's Pi being influenced into this. Now, I don't know if that was a direct influence, Zach.
Fleet Foxes, press return.
What? I mean, did you consciously think about that as you were putting this little Vine piece together? Or were you just like, eh, a second here, it's done.
Yeah, it started that way when I was starting on it. I was just like, hey, I'm just going to film something stupid and see what happens. And then I was like, you know, I just watched this movie and I have 6 seconds, which is really, it's a considerable amount of time if you just do something quick.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, 6 seconds is a
long time. So I was like, well, I can actually do something with this if I just think about it for more than... And then, so... I'll think, hey, I'm going to put a record on my... Well, let's just shoot a Vine real quick and see what I can do. And you can chick, chick, doom, doom, doom. And sometimes it'll work well enough. I'm like, yeah, that's good enough. And if I don't like it, I'll just do it again because it's not taking me a horrible amount of time.
Right.
Yeah, so it's definitely...
But did you allow the audio to play a part in that, or were you just thinking visual? Because that's, to me, that's where it kind of came across.
Yeah.
Is because you hear the album being pulled out of the stack.
Yeah, it's a nice sound.
And then you hear the... platter.
Yeah.
Then you hear the click of the arm being taken off and locking, the needle going down and the initial ksh, and then
the playing.
Cut to the play.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and it's just like that quick. And I was like, wow, what a wonderful rhythm that was created in this. And especially on Vine, it doesn't loop perfect. I mean, it's not a perfect loop,
right? It's not a perfect loop.
But when you watch it and you watch it loop, there's this hypnotic rhythm to what's going on with that. And to me, if subconsciously Pi had that influence on you, then our job is working, right, Rodrigo? I mean, that's the whole point. If you're looking at something and saying, how does this influence my work, whether I'm aware of it or not, I think is a good thing. So congratulations to
Thank
Zach. Go, Zach. Plus, you know, being influenced by Pi is better than most of my influences, which are like...
I've been influenced by Pi for a long time. That's why I'm as big as I am.
Like Target commercials...
Yeah,
and like
Target commercials.
90s music videos. So like if you watch my stuff on TV, it's like, that's a 90s Target commercial.
Yeah.
Or a lot cleaner, but...
What's that Norwegian singer's name?
Bjork.
If you watch her stuff.
Bjork videos.
That has a big influence more than you know. Maybe not in your stuff, but I'm saying when you watch a Bjork video, you're just like, oh, I can see how that influences... Oh, yeah. What's the... what's that band... Crap it. They did that George Millais trip to the moon in their video.
Oh, the Smashing Pumpkins.
Smashing Pumpkins. You can tell that some of their stuff visually is influenced by Bjork videos. Now, I've never gone in to look and see who's directed or who was the visual creative on those. But when I watch some of those Smashing Pumpkins ones, I'm like, this is borderline stuff you'd see in a Bjork video. So, all right. Well, good job, Zach. So, bottom line, did you like Pulp Fiction, yay or nay?
Yeah, it's a really good, really just a solid movie experience. I wish I could see it on a theater screen. It's just one of those movies that I would like to just watch on a just way too big a screen that I can possibly fit into my house and just
like
sit there alone.
Wow, like a giant screen possibly in a home theater system.
Yeah.
Right next door.
Yep.
All right. So, yeah, listeners, if you want to go pick up this film, if you haven't already, head over to majorspoilers.com, click on that amazon.com link, and buy away. Next week, Zach, are you ready for another film that's going to
put me to sleep?
I don't want to say it's going to put you to sleep, but of its time period and films like it, it's pretty typical of that kind of film. We are going into the Western genre next week.
Again.
We are going to take a look at The Magnificent Seven, a film that did have its influences in wherever we started this journey, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Magnificent Seven, we loop around and finish out this big looping. And it also is a mashup and a lead into some Asian films from Asia.
Sweet.
Magnificent Seven, if you've not seen, is a Western remake of The Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So if you've seen The Seven Samurai.
Nope.
Okay. Then you kind of know what's going on. And Seven Samurai, for listeners, is on the list. And I would say in this case, you need to watch Magnificent Seven first and then go and watch Seven Samurai.
I think either way is fine. You'll get something different out of the experience.
But both ways. Yeah. As I've said before.
And then A Bug's Life. Don't do that.
No,
I mean, do it on your own time.
No, seriously. I mean, if you look at remakes, and maybe we'll have a whole future Zach on film just about remakes. Seven Samurai did it first. Magnificent Seven did it next. Bug's Life did it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, George Lucas did it in Star Wars, The Clone Wars episode. It's totally that.
And there have been 1,000 versions of the Magnificent Seven.
Oh, yeah.
What is it? Samurai
the three
Seven.
Amigos, the Three Amigos
there,
did
there
it.
There was a literal anime remake of the Seven Samurai called Samurai Seven.
Oh, really?
In which some of the samurai are
space
robots.
Robots, okay. Yes. All right, listeners, that wraps it up for this installment of Zach on Film, Major Spoilers, Issue 510. Thank you so much for downloading. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for everyone that comments and appreciates what we're doing with this. Hopefully you're learning a little bit from this. Zach, are you continuing to learn?
All the time.
All right, we will spin this off into its own show in the very near future that you will be able to download and listen to in its very own feed. Or what I might suggest for those of you that want to listen to more shows from the Major Spoilers Podcast Network is go over to iTunes or head over to majorspoilers.com. You will be able to get the RSS feed, or you can go into iTunes and look for Major Spoilers Podcast Network, where every single show we produce is in one giant master feed, and you can have access to everything anytime. Thank you once again, Rodrigo, for being here. Thank you, Zach, for being here. And listeners, thank you for being here. And until next time, I don't know, what's a good closer for Zach on Film?
Zach on Film.
If I had the X-ray vision of a Superman, I could save some bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the rack. And although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, he'd make me wait out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Away. If I was hulking green or gray, I could bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little me would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would you bag and board your comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler, yeah. What a major spoiler.
Major Spoilers is copyright 2013.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.